Welcome back to New Books in Religion. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. Today I had the pleasure of speaking with Mary Jane Rubenstein about her great new book, Worlds Without End, The Many Lives of the Multiverse, published with Columbia University Press in 2014. Where can the boundaries of science, philosophy, and religion be drawn? Questioning the nature of the universe is an excellent place to rethink how these categories have been deployed across time. In this beautifully written and beautifully designed book, Mary Jane Rubenstein offers a genealogy of multiple world cosmologies that demonstrate the pliability of these terms and the debated relationship between science and religion. She wonders why there's a proliferation of multiverse theoretical cosmologies by contemporary scientists. While the cosmos are generally considered to be singular and finite, many well-respected physicists explain the universe's complexities as evidence of a multiverse. These explanations argue that our world is just one of the infinite numbers of universes existing simultaneously. Worlds Without End shows that multiple world cosmologies have had currency among many thinkers for over 2,500 years. What draws philosophers, religious practitioners, and scientists together on these questions is their appeal to metaphysical postulates, which serve as pseudo-theologies for the contemporary age. In our conversation, we discuss the Greek philosophical tradition of Plato, Aristotle, the Atomist, and Stoics, medieval Christian interpreters such as Thomas Aquinas, Nicholas of Cusa, Giordano Bruno, the telescopic discoveries of Galileo, René Descartes, Isaac Newton, Immanuel Kant, the Big Bang debate, cosmic shredding, the fine-tuning problem, dark energy, inflationary cosmology, string theory, quantum mechanics, and intelligent design, among many, many other things. It really was a pleasure speaking with Mary Jane Rubenstein and reading her wonderful book, Worlds Without End. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Without further ado, here's the interview. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Thank you, Mary Jane, for joining us. How are you doing?
Thank you so much. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Now, this is a really wonderful book. I really enjoyed this genealogical approach where you take this now kind of very popular conception of the multiverse and really place it into these kind of larger conversations that have been going on for centuries. Before we get into the content of the book, I really would love if you could situate yourself in the study of religion. How did you get interested in religious studies? Perhaps people that have been influential in perhaps either your approach or the topics you study. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, of course. Thanks. I got into religious studies by accident. I think that that's more common than one might like to imagine. I was thrown accidentally into an introduction to religion class my freshman year of college, having been trying to get into some theater class, and it didn't fit in my schedule, and the only thing that fit was religion, and I didn't know what it meant to study religion. And it was one of these, you know how sometimes religious studies courses are structured around sort of the world religions, and then other times they're structured more sort of theoretically and methodologically. And it was one of those classes. It was a sort of theory and method heavy class that looked at particular case studies, but that was really a kind of what I would think of as a highly philosophical class. And I was just totally transfixed by it, and you know, fell in love, I guess, typically with Kierkegaard and Tillich, and these, you know, radical Protestant thinkers who were trying to think past the limits of the thinkable. And just thought pretty clearly, I guess, in that first semester, like, this is the stuff that I would like ideally to do forever. Like, I'd like to figure out what kind of job I could have out there in the world that would let me read Fear and Trembling all the time. Like, what could I do to do that?
Great. Go on. So then you decided to continue your studies, obviously.
I did. I majored in religion, and again, the department at the institution where I was an undergraduate was highly theoretically organized. It was basically a major in post-structuralist philosophy, actually, with like a little bit of religious studies thrown in. I was lucky enough to have a fellowship to spend a couple of years studying in Cambridge, and signed up to get a master's degree in theology, thinking, of course, theology was the same thing as religious studies, and had no idea what I was getting myself into. So I got overseas and had to learn really quickly, you know, with my sense of the canon had been, you know, Tillich and Kierkegaard and then like Lacan and Judith Butler and Kristeva. And then it turned out that there were these guys named Augustine and Anselm and like even Kant, whom I had just not dealt with at all. So I had to figure out what the heck theology was, and was really approached it from a religious studies background. So I guess the terrain that I got sort of trained up in was somewhere between theory, method, and religion, continental philosophy, and the sort of history of theology and Western philosophy.
Great. Now, this book is your second book, and I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what began you thinking about multiple world cosmologies. You mention in, I think, the introduction or somewhere that Clayton Crockett asked you to join right. him in a conference. Could you talk a little bit about where did this project begin to emerge, and then what made you think this should be a book length project, and then how you approached that?
Thanks. Yeah. So there's the I guess if I were doing this, if I were responding to this in any kind of professional, formal, or responsible way, I would probably talk about this attraction to mine toward thinkers and now scientists who operate at the limits of the imaginable, right? So, and from there, you can kind of draw a wiggly line, but some sort of line between thinkers like Kierkegaard and Heidegger and Derrida and contemporary cosmologists who are attempting to sort of imagine the unimaginable and push out the limits of the possible and the representable. And so that would be the responsible way to answer it. Yeah, the irresponsible way is to say, once again, that this was a big accident. And Clayton had been asking me for weeks to join him in Central Arkansas at a conference on theology and energy. And I responded, no, you know, as you know, I don't do theology. And also, I know nothing about energy. Like, I barely know how my house is heated. I have nothing to say about energy. I have no... I respectfully wrote, no thanks, you know, you're wonderful, but no thank you. And Clayton wrote back the next day and said, please come. And I wrote back and said, no, no thank you, I really can't. And he wrote back to me for a week, every day for a week, saying, just come up with something. So finally, because I was sick of answering the emails, I told him I would come. And that weekend happened to be reading a piece in the New York Times magazine by Dennis Overby on he does popular writing for the Times on mainly on physics and cosmology. And so he was writing about this thing, this substance, this weird, mysterious substance called dark energy, which is it's hard to give it a noun, but it seems to be the pressure of empty space that is causing the universe not only to expand, right? We've known since the 30s, really, and definitively since the 60s, that the universe is expanding, but to actually to accelerate its expansion. And it was a total, discovering it was a total surprise for the researchers who found it. They were horrified by it, and they gave it this funny name, dark energy. And I started thinking that the sort of metaphorics in operation surrounding this term and the way that the physicists were talking about it as creepy or as hellish or as just unbearable were just fascinating on the one hand. And on the other hand, sounded highly theological, that there was something about the surprise, the astonishment of this thing, the astonishment that the universe might somehow be racing beyond the universe's own capacity to hold itself in. And I thought, well, why did they why did they assume the universe could hold itself in, right? Why would they assume that the expansion of the universe would somehow be benevolently regulated by the universe itself? There seemed to be, to me, some kind of leftover ontotheological longing for some reciprocity of universal procession on the one hand and return on the other hand, that it, you know, all things would proceed from and to some kind of alpha and omega. So I started just reading up as much as I possibly could on dark energy and trying to attend to the way that scientists were talking about this stuff. And then read it in relation to, in relation to Eastern Orthodox theologies of procession and return, the so-called energies of God. There's something very interesting about this term energy and its overlap here between physics and theology. The more that I read about dark energy, the more I started tumbling into writings about the multiverse. So it was at that point that I was so in, and it took me so long to figure out even how to make my way through this new discursive terrain that once I was in it, I had a very hard time getting out, and the book just sort of grew from my following a sense that there was something bizarrely and even sort of perversely going on, perversely theological going on in contemporary cosmology.
Now, the book centers around this idea of a multiverse.
Right.
Which, I mean, basically you explain in various ways throughout the whole book, but to give us kind of a starting point, when people use the word multiverse today, I guess, what are they thinking about? Can you kind of just give us a blurry line definition, I guess?
Sure. Yeah. Blurry line definition. At the moment, what the term multiverse refers to is a hypothetical compendium. So there's no proof that there's a multiverse. There's no consensus that there's a multiverse. Most physicists are pretty convinced that there is, but it's a hypothetical compendium of universes, period. So then we have to ask what a universe is. A universe is the collection of space-time centered on any given point in space-time that covers basically everything you can see from wherever you are. So you may have seen images of what's called our Hubble volume or our light cone. It's basically a sphere drawn around any given point that shows all the stuff we can see from here, which is to say the space-time accessible by observation to us, the distance, as it were, that light has been able to travel to us since the Big Bang. So that's known as our visible universe. And then sometimes when physicists talk about the universe, they mean like everything we can see from here. And then other times when they talk about the universe, they mean everything the Big Bang produced. So those are two different ways of talking about universe. What the multiverse hypothesis says is there are more universes out there, either in time or in space, that look either just like us, a little bit like us, or absolutely nothing like us. And then from there, there's all kinds of disagreement about, you know, where these multiverses are, whether they exist out there in space or out there in time. And I know, you know, this, we're running up against the limits of concepts here, because space-time, of course, are the same thing. But some models of the multiverse configure other universes as like out there. Like if we could just travel faster than the speed of light, we could see them beyond the bounds of our universe. Some models of the multiverse configure them more temporally, which is to say, after our universe unravels in some way, either in some big shredding or a big crunch or something like that, right, where we do the Big Bang backwards, there will be another Big Bang and another universe. And there are tens or hundreds of these models that are some kind of negotiation of the spatial and the temporal to try to get us to sort of see how there might be multiple universes and in many cases even an infinite number of universes.
Great. Now, for contemporary cosmologists, you set up in the beginning of the book that the, I guess, why this has all of a sudden become a common way of thinking about the cosmos is with something called the fine-tuning problem. And basically, it's they're trying to seek how we make sense of the cosmos, you know, in relation to things like intelligent design and dark energy, which you mentioned before. So can you tell us, like, what's going on with the cosmos that has been discovered recently that is motivating people to think about the cosmos in this way? What is this fine-tuning problem all about?
Yeah, great. And so it's at this point that the question, as you're suggesting, that guides this book is, why the heck are contemporary physicists, why do they want a multiverse? Why are they taking this seriously? I mean, the idea of an infinite number of parallel universes sounds insane. Even if it's not insane, it sounds like the stuff of, you know, our most fantastic science fiction, our most fantastic films and sort of Borgesian short stories, which is absolutely wonderful, but doesn't sound like what we think of as contemporary observation-based Popperian modern science. So what is it that has driven physicists to need a multiverse? And it's in this sense that I think this book operates in what we could call the realm of religious studies, which is to say that, I guess, if you can make a kind of rough mapping between, I know that these differences are really fraught, but if you had to make a distinction between, say, constructive theology and religious studies, you'd say, all right, well, constructive theology asks, how ought we to think about God and our relationship to God, or how ought we to think about our, where the universe came from and our responsibilities to it and things like that. Whereas religious studies tends to ask things like, why do these people ask these questions, right? Or why do those people come up with these teachings? What is it about the norms of this community that produce these kinds of stories and convictions and practices in the first place? It's at that register that I'm operating with respect to physicists. It's like physicists become the kind of, I don't know, what somebody like J.Z. Smith or Russ McCutcheon would call a kind of native theologian, right? The question becomes, all right, why do these folks want a multiverse so badly? And the answer, sorry, that's all the backfill to your question. And the answer is, well, over the last three decades, in particular, the number of so-called fine tunings of the universe have multiplied. And the fine tunings of the universe refer to the constants of nature. So the gravitational constant is a constant, right? Gravity pushes down, well, it holds planets in order. It is the warping of space and time. But right, gravity holds planets in orbit around the sun. Gravity holds our feet on the ground. And it has a particular constant. Why, the question becomes, is the gravitational constant the value that it is? Why does it have the value that it has? Why isn't it any stronger? Why isn't it any weaker? And you can ask these about all the fundamental constants of the universe. So, for example, the strong nuclear force and the weak nuclear force that hold molecules and nuclei together. You can ask it about... then this becomes the big issue. Dark energy, which is to say the pressure of empty space, is itself a constant of the universe. And with each question, why is this constant this way rather than that way, we physicists start to realize that if any of these constants had even like a slightly different value from the one that it has, life as we know it, the universe as we know it, would look nothing like it looks right now. So if you imagine gravity being stronger, for example, things couldn't grow as high. In fact, if gravity were even a little stronger, nothing could sort of rise up from the Earth at all. But if it were a little bit weaker, we would all go flying into orbit, which is to say we would never be here in the first place because every sort of proto-biotic form would have been thrown off into space. So gravity seems to be calculated on this sort of razor's edge of probability, whereas if it were any stronger, we'd be squashed, and if it were any weaker, we'd be in orbit. And of course, the easiest theological answer to the question, why is gravity this way, right? Why is it so precisely calculated? Is that there is an extra cosmic, benevolent, intelligent, and powerful God who sets gravity just right so that God's creatures can grow and flourish, right? And I think here about God as a kind of mixologist or DJ, like adding just the right amount of gravity and just the right amount of strong and weak nuclear forces and making the electron just the right. So in 1998, with the discovery of dark energy, what the quick calculations determined was that if dark energy, which is to say, again, this pressure of empty space itself, if dark energy were any stronger, then galaxies would have flown away from one another that they couldn't have formed in the first place. And in fact, the entire sort of proto-universe would have ripped itself into shreds before anything could form. And if dark energy were any weaker, after the initial Big Bang, sort of birth of the universe, all matter would have sort of flown away from itself so slowly that actually the expansive force would have contracted and the universe would have been drawn back into some kind of big crunch and would have been annihilated that way. So dark energy becomes a kind of like the last straw in this long list of fine-tuned constants. And again, if a physicist is asking, if a fundamental physicist is asking, why is it that these things are so precariously calculated? A very easy answer is, well, there's a God out there making sure that it all works out right. The other possibility, at least so far, has just been to say, well, don't ask the question, right? It's just dumb luck that our constants are the way they are. It's a stupid question. Let's just work with the values we're given. But if you really want to ask the question, it seems that sort of an extra cosmic creator might be your only option until you get the idea of a multiverse, which is to say, you can get the idea that we are not the only universe out there. So our values are not the only possible values. Rather, there are other universes out there, maybe even, this is where this becomes important, an infinite number of universes out there. And if there are an infinite number of universes out there, then each of those universes is going to try on different parameters and sort of see how the universe goes. And some universes will blow up in fiery explosions and some will sort of contract in fiery implosions and some will sort of wither away. But every once in a while, you'll get a universe whose constants are, say, just right, sort of Goldilocks principle, and we just happen to be in one of those universes. So the multiverse becomes a kind of rival, and not a kind of, the multiverse becomes a rival hypothesis to that of an extra cosmic creator. It becomes the way that you can explain how this universe got the way it is without having to appeal to anything like a god.
Now, perhaps since you kind of set up your answer with this, we can jump to the punchline of kind of what's going on in this book more generally. And so part of what you do in the last section of the book, and perhaps we'll return to some of the details of these multiverse theories afterward, is you basically argue that these multiverse cosmologies are acting metaphysically, and you take a very, broad but also technical sense of what metaphysics is. So, can you maybe explain, how this works? Are these pseudo theological, perhaps, and what exactly does that mean then for the boundaries of these broader categories of religion and science? Do they really, I guess, are they as static as we might imagine them to be?
Right. Great. Let me answer that backwards. I think that the categories of religion, the categories of religion and science are in beautiful, productive, and exciting flux with respect to the multiverse for two reasons. One is that the multiverse has a philosophical and theological history that I try to uncover in the pages of this book, so that theology and philosophy provide the narrative, conceptual, and theoretical conditions of possibility for even thinking a multiverse in the first place. So that's one reason we get sort of what right now counts as these separate categories of religion, science, philosophy, all informing one another. And then the second reason is that even in its contemporary scientific iterations, I think multiverse cosmology and multiverse cosmologies are operating at the very least metaphysically, and in many cases, I think theologically, and one can say that pretty straightforwardly. What I mean when I say that multiverse physics operates metaphysically is kind of multi-layered, but at its most basic level, multiverse cosmologies are operating in response to what is fundamentally a metaphysical question, which is to say, why is the universe this way and not any other way? Or why is there a universe and not nothing, right? Why is there something rather than nothing? This is the fundamental metaphysical question. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why is the universe the way it is? These are metaphysical questions because the why cannot be determined from within the cosmos that is asking the question, right? The why is a metaphysical question. And so, again, there are certain physicists, most, you know, operational working physicists, who don't ask these why questions. Most of my colleagues in physics and even in astronomy sort of shake their heads in disbelief at these cosmologists who are coming up with these crazy ideas. And the difference is that these particular experimental and even theoretical physicists are not interested in that basic, why are these the values that they are kinds of questions. So the minute you become a physicist who needs to know why, right, needs to know why the universe is the way it is, you're at the very least a philosopher, in addition to being a physicist. And you may be sort of careening into the territory, veering into the territory of theology. And we can talk in sort of more specific ways about how that happens with different multiverse scenarios. So the why, I want to suggest, the why is a metaphysical question. So it can only produce metaphysical answers, right? Even the most sort of sober and staunchly atheistic cosmologist Steven Weinberg, Andre Linde, will say, look, we either have God or we have a multiverse, but we don't have any other rival. Like there's no other explanation. So whether it's an infinite external creator or an infinite number of parallel universes, your answer to your metaphysical question, why is the universe the way it is metaphysical, which is to say you're positing a bunch of stuff out there that explains why the stuff in here is the way it is. So in the terms of metaphysics being pertaining to that which lies beyond our universe, I think very straightforwardly you can see contemporary physics is operating metaphysically. That having been said, I think it also makes some interesting interventions into metaphysics in the more sort of Heideggerian sense of pertaining to what is, right? Metaphysics always wants to ask what counts as is-ness, what counts as being. If traditionally the universe has meant the compendium of all that is, right, everything that is, multiverse theories are thinking of multiple is-es. They're thinking of many is-es. So there's this pressure on the very concept of being, the very concept of is, at the limits of multiverse cosmology that forces, I think, physicists, philosophers, theorists of all stripes, to think about what we mean by being and what we mean by isness and whether all that is one or whether all that is multiple or thrown right back upon the question of the one and the many. And because it delivers us into that terrain, I think, in a more sort of technical sense, modern cosmology is operating metaphysically as well.
Great. The what you're doing in many of the chapters here is really kind of demonstrating that while we might have an assumption that there's a cosmic singularity, this idea of kind of multiple world cosmologies is not something new. You start with the Greek tradition, Plato and Aristotle. Can you tell us about why they're thinking about kind of multiple world cosmologies? In what context are they kind of breaking away from, and what are they? How do they conceive of these cosmologies?
Sure. So right. So the our sort of dominant. Let me start with the beginning of the 20th century. At the beginning of the 20th century, Edwin Hubble discovers galaxies beyond our Milky Way. And this is a complete shock. This is an utter shock. Einstein had thought, before Hubble's discovery, that our entire universe was what we now know to be our Milky Way, surrounded by an endless, vast void. And that was it. That we were all that was out there. Our galaxy was all that was out there. And the possibility that there were even more than one galaxy was absolutely astonishing to early 20th century physicists. Now, this is amazing because the idea of multiple, that we wouldn't have called it galaxies, but multiple worlds, and our galaxy, right, was the only world, has a 2,500-year-old history that got beautifully and carefully papered over by a kind of dominant reign of what I would call cosmic singularity, the idea that the world we live in is the only world. And there are a lot of contributors to this this sort of hegemonic story about our world being the only world. Of course, lots of people like to blame Christianity. The story of theology's relationship, Christian theology's relation to this, is very complicated. But the first real big players here are Plato and Aristotle, who both insist that there is only one world. There has ever only been one world. There can only be one world, and that any other any sort of argument to the contrary has to be wrong. So, of course, one wants to ask, why were Plato and Aristotle so exercised about this cosmic oneness thing? Like, why did they care so much? And they were writing, as you know, lots of other schools going on in ancient Greece, right, in Athens. And there were two in particular, and you know, Plato was more familiar, of course, with the atomists. The Stoics are going to come along a little bit later. Two major schools of thought in ancient Greek philosophy that posited that our universe was actually one of an infinite number of universes. And these two were the atomists on the one hand, so Democritus, Leucippus, and then later we get Epicurus, whose work is, of course, recorded in Lucretius's Nature of Things. So the atomists on the one hand and the Stoics on the other. The atomists are a bit older. And what the atomists are doing is asserting an infinite number of worlds just like ours. So of course, what you want to ask is, why were the atomists so excited about an infinite number of worlds? What were they reacting to? And what they were reacting to was, frankly, creation theology. They were reacting to very early versions of what we might call the intelligent design hypothesis, the idea that if you just contemplate the beauty and harmony of the world around us, you have to see the hands of some benevolent creator who established the world for our benefit, right? So that it's as harmonious and beautiful and seamless as possible. And what the atomists wanted to say was, you know what? Religion is making us crazy. It is forcing us into all kinds of useless rituals. It keeps us in fear of the gods. It's sort of ethically disastrous. And so what they said instead was, there is actually a very straightforward way to view the world as a product of chance and just accident rather than of any kind of design. And the way they did it, surprise, surprise, was by appealing to an infinite number of worlds. They said that there's an infinite number of atoms out there. There's an infinite number of space. These atoms collide with one another haphazardly throughout infinite time. And every once in a while, a cluster of atoms gets together successfully and makes a world sort of like ours, which lives for a time, and then it dissolves and goes on to form new worlds later. So for the atomists, there were worlds out there beyond what we could see. There were worlds before ours. There would be worlds afterwards. But their primary motivation was this anti-theological stance, right? That rather than saying there's an intelligent designer, they could say, no, no, there's just accident and there's infinity. And with those two principles combined, every once in a while, you'll get a world that works. You can probably hear, right, that the modern multiverse argument is drawing on the same conviction that the principles of accident and infinity can replace the need for any kind of benevolent God. The Stoics, so we could see that the atomists really as having again, crudely, we could call a kind of spatial multiplicity of universes. There are other worlds out there beyond the boundaries of our own. The Stoics, on the other hand, posited that our world is the only world right now. But, you know, like every once in a while, I don't know, a trillion years or so, like every once in a while, The sun gets really hungry and consumes the entire world in flames, sets the whole world on fire. The world is destroyed, leaving only a tiny little bit of air, a spirit, and a tiny little bit of matter. And from out of that ruined world, spirit, pneuma, will recreate the world again. So this is what's known as a phoenix universe. It is destroyed in flames and then reborn periodically. And the Stoics are convinced, this is fascinating, that insofar as reason ordered the world is perfect the way it is. And so that this means that every successive world is going to emerge just like the one that had preceded it. So worlds repeat infinitely and in infinite sameness. So you and I have had this conversation an infinite number of times before, and we're going to have an infinite number of times into the future. Each of us has lived this life an infinite number of times and will do this again. So those are basically the two rival schools of sort of cosmic multiplicity that get going in the ancient world, the kind of spatial multiplicity of the atomists, the temporal multiplicity of the Stoics. Plato does everything he can to insist that our world is the only possible world. Why does he want to do this? Because he hates the idea of the universe or the world ending, unraveling in any way. And so he, in the Timaeus, Plato, insists that the world must be singular, because and he does it by appealing to an extra cosmic creator. He's got a demiurge, who doesn't create out of nothing, but he creates. And a demiurge makes the earth in such a way that it will never dissolve because it is internally perfect and there are no worlds out there beside it to unravel it or to cause it to decay. Aristotle, of course, thinks that Plato has the right idea in terms of just having one world, but that he can't prove it. So Aristotle comes up with different ways to prove that the universe has to be singular. But from, you know, Plato and Aristotle on, the dominant cosmological trend in the West is going to insist that this be the only universe.
Now, that stays the standard for several hundred years. And you jump next to Thomas Aquinas, who is positing in one of his works, he says, it seems that there is not one world, but many. And so why is he asking this question? Wasn't this debate over a long time ago? What's happening and how is he responding to this idea of multiple world cosmologies?
Right. So Thomas is the product, as you know, of a sort of Latin rediscovery of the works of Aristotle, which had been preserved in Arabic translation. So when Thomas is saying it seems that there is not world, that there may not be one world but many, he is responding to the texts to which Aristotle is responding, the kinds of arguments to which Aristotle is responding. Of course, this is the scholastic style, so we can, you know, just by the form of the question, we know that the very idea of many worlds would be absolutely insane to Thomas Aquinas, just because of the place he puts it in his question. Thomas is basically the last. Is this right? I think this is right. Thomas is the last major Christian intellectual to insist that the world has to be singular. Augustine before him has this hilarious refutation of the Stoics in the City of God. I mean, it would be hilarious if it weren't so desperate, but Aquinas really takes it down throughout the Summa. And what's at stake for Aquinas is actually the singularity of the creator. Thomas hinges the singularity of the universe, of the world, sorry, on the singularity of God. He, like Aristotle, believed that for each moved, there would have to be a mover. To assert the plurality of the cosmos would be to assert the plurality of God. And this was just absolutely unacceptable, of course, to Thomas. So he goes through a number of sort of neo-Aristotelian with a little bit of Augustine in it proofs to demonstrate the singularity of the cosmos. Now, of course, what's crazy is that Thomas Aquinas dies in 1274, and that 3 years later, 1277, the condemnations of 1277 are written by Bishop Etienne Tompier of Paris. There are tons and tons of condemnations, but one of them condemns as heretical the teaching that God could not make more than one world. So all of a sudden, and as you probably know, Thomas gets posthumously called up on heresy charges. His old teacher has to defend him once he's dead. It's terrible. But anyway, so one of the now heretical positions that Thomas set forward was the notion that God could only create one world. And of course, the theological motivations for that concern the power of God, that to assert that God could only create one universe would be to circumscribe God's power. Why couldn't an infinite God create infinite universes? Wouldn't the power of an infinite God actually be augmented by God's ability to create an infinite number of universes? So it's really, Pierre Duhem says that the condemnations of 1277 are actually the kind of birth certificate of modern science, because they reopen a series of heretofore unimaginable possibilities. And one of them, of course, is the possibility of an infinite number of worlds.
And I guess that's a good explanation, because this is where we kind of enter murky water for people writing in Christian contexts. And you talk about Nicholas of Cusa, and you talk about Giordano
right.
Bruno, who
right.
are starting to think about, you know, how could these multiple world cosmologies fit into, I guess, Christian theologies. Can you tell us a little bit about this period after Aquinas and how people are thinking about this?
Right. So the period after Aquinas. So Nicholas of Cusa is fascinating. You know, he long before Copernicus had the conviction, and not so much an observational conviction, but really a theological conviction, nothing created could be the measure of anything else, that God was the measure of all things. But what this meant was that there could be nothing stable, static, or central in the created universe. With Cusa, we start getting more sort of universe language. So Cusa has this idea that the earth, again, way before Copernicus, that the earth is not at the center of the universe. Of course, the dominant model before, what we hear is before Copernicus, had been the Ptolemaic model, which is sort of infused Aristotelianism, the idea that the earth is at the center, right? And then the planets and fixed stars and sun all revolve around the earth. Nicholas of Cusa says, no, the earth's not at the center of the universe. As we know, Copernicus is going to say this about 100 years later, that the sun is at the center of the universe. Nicholas actually says nothing is at the center of the universe. Nothing is the center. He says wherever you are in the universe, you can call that the center if you want. But the universe is actually, the word he uses is boundless. It's unbounded. He won't quite say it's infinite for reasons that will become clear in a minute, but the universe is boundless. So there's no center and there's no periphery. Rather, the center is anywhere you happen to find yourself. And the periphery is the bounds of whatever you can see. So again, Nicholas was careful to say that the universe was boundless. It had what he called a contracted infinity, whereas God, he called infinite. God was uncontracted infinity. So the universe is not quite infinite because it depends for its being at every point on its creator, whereas God depends on nothing. So God is a kind of uncontracted infinity. But for Nicholas, basically the whole universe is in the image of God for Cusa, in at least De Docta Ignorantia. He opens past the primacy of the human as the imago Dei, and he says, no, the universe is in the image of God. And insofar as the universe is in the image of God, the universe itself couldn't be bound by anything outside itself. So the universe, like God, is boundless. Fascinatingly, sort of pre-modern, post-modern, pre-modern cosmology there in Nicholas. Now, what Giordano Bruno does now after Copernicus is he basically takes Cusan cosmology and like turns up the volume, which is to say, he proclaims that the universe is infinite. It's just infinite. It's not contractedly infinite. It's not boundless. It's infinite, just like God. For Bruno, the universe is the unmediated, direct, eternal, actually, outpouring of its infinite God. And it would be actually an absolute insult to call the universe anything less than fully infinite. It would be an insult to God to call God's creation anything less than infinite. So for Bruno, we have this infinite universe filled with innumerable worlds, with an infinite number of worlds. So I would say, you know, Bruno is the first sort of early modern, like just on the brink of modernity, multiverse theorist, actually. And of course, Cusa and Bruno with these, you know, fascinatingly similar cosmologies, Bruno actually takes a lot out of Nicholas, but he thinks that he wasn't quite bold enough. They have very, very wildly different fates. You know, Nicholas is made into a cardinal of the church, whereas Bruno is burned at the stake in 1600, becoming a kind of martyr for the new science. Right, he then gets drawn into that line that stretches through Copernicus, both through Copernicus before him, through Galileo after him. But again, what's interesting is that Bruno's arguments had been primarily theologically motivated, right? They were not observationally motivated. He was trying to make an argument about the being of God and what the universe God created would have to look like in order to do justice to the infinity of divinity.
Great. Now, you move on to the 17th century, which becomes, I guess, critical because we have Galileo's kind of discoveries of this, you know, telescopically viewed world that can be observed. And we have a lot of people then arguing for a singular universe, but we also have this rather widespread, you know, theories of multiple world cosmologies going on with very important people like Descartes and Kant. Could you talk a little bit about this contradiction? We have this new observable data, which perhaps could at the time be seen as evidence for singular world. But we still have people thinking very critically about these multiple worlds.
Right. So this is where I think the sort of fairly common, perhaps knee-jerk criticism of Christian theology as being anti-imaginative and anti-scientific, anti-rational, anti-whatever, it becomes a little bit unhelpful. Because what happens in the 17th century is that with the development, so of course you can focus on Bruno and say, you know, the church executed Bruno, the church hates the truth, or, you know, whatever it is, right? And then, of course, the house arrest of Galileo and all of the rest of it. But interestingly, it's not, in the 17th century, it is not the case that the church is somehow reining science in and restraining it from blossoming. Rather, science is restraining itself. So with the development of the telescope, which, of course, extends our vision beyond beyond the Earth, right, to other cosmic bodies. With the development of the telescope and the sort of extension of vision, we actually also get a kind of contraction of imagination in what turns out to be observational astronomy. So the question of the possibility of multiple worlds becomes first in the sort of emergent scientific literature, first confined to questions about, like, whether there's life on other planets, whether there's life on the moon or on Jupiter or on Venus. Kepler has some fascinating possibilities about the possibility of inhabitants on other planets. But our sense of what world is becomes severely delimited. So rather than being, you know, vastly other world, they're just other planets. So again, with the expansion of vision with a telescope, our sort of imaginative vision is getting constrained. And by the time that we get to Newton, Newton really is not concerned with the possibility of other worlds at all. He, like sort of emerging throng of new scientists, are arguing that we really need to confine our vision to our vision, to the world we can measure and see. And this strangely frees up the philosophers and the theologians, even after the mid 17th century, when the church loses its power over such things, to start thinking about the possibility of multiple worlds again. And you get this explosion in the mid to late 17th century of multiple worlds cosmologies, most of which are building off the vortex cosmology of René Descartes. Descartes can really be seen, as he can in everything, as the kind of intersection of all these disciplines. He's in that funny crossover between what would become science, philosophy, theology, mathematics, optics, right, as separate disciplines, and kind of does it all at once. So his is like the last great proto-scientific cosmology and cosmogony. But the people who are writing, you know, Cartesian dreams about infinite universes are themselves more in the sort of literary and philosophical and even theological camps. So you have this kind of crossover, right, in the 17th century where science is all of a sudden becoming very conservative, deeply restrained to the world that it can measure and see. And the non-scientific sort of humanities, and so the humanities really, are sort of set free to imagine other possible worlds.
Great. Now, the final section of the book, you really kind of take us through a world tour of contemporary multiple world cosmologies, some of the factors that gave rise to these, why people are starting to think about these in the 20th century and then into today. Perhaps we can leave the details of those to people, and they force them to go out and buy the book. But could you talk a little bit, I mean, you've kind of been hinting at it throughout the conversation, but why is there so many, right? You mentioned tens and even maybe hundreds of different ideas about this. Why is this so important now? Why is it being taken seriously as scientific theories where, you know, people like Plato, Descartes, these are often thought of as philosophies, right? So why is this now thought of as science, right? Why are scientists thinking about this?
Right. So again, I think the kind of central answer, at least the central working answer, is that physics needs an answer to the fine tunings of the universe, right, and finds the only compelling non-theological answer in the multiverse. Now, of course, it's not clear to me that the multiverse is non-theological, but to the extent that it doesn't appeal to an extra cosmic humanoid creator, the multiverse can be seen as non-theistic and is the only possible answer. But yes, as you're saying, right, there are tons of sort of rival models of the multiverse. The dominant model of the multiverse is called the inflationary multiverse, coming out of the inflationary cosmology. That again, yes, you can read more about. I won't bore anybody with it right now. But a lot of the rivals to the inflationary universe or the inflationary multiverse will claim aesthetic distaste for the scenario. They'll say, I hate it. I hate the idea that there are an infinite number of universes being bubbled out for no reason, haphazardly, and all this empty space is being waste. It's just gross. And I've tried to track some of the sort of aesthetic and even existential revulsion at the possibilities that the dominant scenario presents. And so these theorists will try to work within different paradigms, just try to work from a different starting place to produce different models. Now, of course, in terms of the, you know, rigors and strictures of observational science, the model that will ultimately win out here, if any model ever does win out, is going to be the one that has the most observational evidence. And with the discovery of B modes, gravitational waves on the cosmic microwave background radiation a few months ago, all of a sudden you were hearing the inflationary theorists say, ha ha, all of our rivals are gone. We win. This is it, right? We've found the B modes and this confirms our theory. The multiverse looks the way we say the multiverse looks. Within 20 hours, all of the rivals were going in and saying, no, 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 my model also supports that data. My model also supports this story. So, you know, you could just see this as sort of turf warfare, right? The people in loop quantum gravity are trying to keep their discipline safe, and the people in string theory are trying to keep their discipline safe from the people who are, you know, just straightforward cosmologists. You could see it that way. And I guess that there is there's some sort of turf war going on, and there's certainly competition for financing and for funding and all of the rest of it. But I think the bigger, at least the more compelling answer to why there are so many rival models of the multiverse is that, again, we're dealing necessarily with that which lies beyond our ability to measure, observe, or see it clearly at all. So there is going to be no definitive way to account for that which we cannot define. That's just, right? There are going to have to be multiple models of the immeasurable, the not quite visible, the not quite seeable. And if we take any kind of lesson from quantum physics, what we know is that even the stuff in this world doesn't necessarily give us a straightforward singular answer, the straightforward singular answer that we're looking for. What we know from the double slit experiment is that if you set up an experiment that's going to measure light as a wave, light is a wave. And if you set up an experiment that's going to measure light as a particle, light is a particle. And it's not that, you know, light is a half particle and a half wave, or light is a particle under certain conditions and is a wave under other conditions. And those two things, particle being and wave being, are totally incompatible with one another. And yet you get totally different results based on the kind of experiment you set up. I have a sense that the multiverse works sort of similarly, that the answer you get about the answer you get to the question, what is all that is, will take on the parameters of the question that you ask and the means you have for investigating it. So if you're going at it with loop quantum gravity, you're going to get a loop quantum gravity answer. And if you go at it with string theory, you're going to get a string theory answer. And if you go at it with, you know, evangelical multiverse commitments, which there are, you're going to get an evangelical multiverse. All right. So the answers that we get are going to depend upon the shape of the questions that we're asking.
Mary Jane, thanks so much. We've talked for a while, and I appreciate your time. Is there anything else you want to tell us about the book that perhaps we didn't get to address yet?
Oh my goodness! The only thing
there's lots, but perhaps something you want to let listeners know about.
Two things. One, Immanuel Kant is more exciting than you think he is. When he's in his early 30s, he has this gorgeous sort of multiversal musing that he then has to disavow radically when he's older and more sober. But it's really worth a trek through the Kantian multiverse. Totally unexpected, really exciting. And the other, of course, is the very serious possibility that we could be living in some kind of computer simulation, right? And that these things that we think are just mediating, for example, the conversation that you and I are having right now, are actually the generators of the universe that we believe that we're in.
Great. Could you let us know a little bit about what you're working on now, perhaps things you have coming out in the future? I'm sure listeners would be very excited to read more of your work.
Sure. So I think for me, the question that came up throughout this book, the frustration, the sort of meta frustration throughout this book that came up for me was the stalemate that so many conversations between religion and science tend to hit because they are duking it out over the existence or non-existence of an extra cosmic, all-powerful, male, humanoid, father-like creator. And it seems to me that if you start from that guy, you're going to have a really dissatisfying and often comically ridiculous conversation. And that there are, not only is, you know, that kind of theism scientifically useless, it's also theologically inappropriate and totally uninteresting, right? And there are theologies that have been in operation for centuries and centuries do not posit that kind of static, self-identical, humanoid creator out in the sky. That having been said, the range of what's sort of acceptable theology is an interesting one to track. So what I've begun to look at are different ways of configuring a sort of divine and creative principle as internal to the cosmos. And of course, the limit point there, at least for the Western tradition, is what's known as pantheism, which is to say the identification of God and the universe. Arguably, the thing that got Giordano Bruno executed in 1600. Pantheism is like the unassimilable category within the Western canon, and I'm trying to figure out why it is that that position is so demonized, so feminized, so primitivized. What's so dangerous about pantheism? So that's where I'm headed next.
Great, sounds really interesting. Perhaps you can join us again when that comes out.
I would love to.
Well, thanks again, Mary Jane. We really appreciate your time and appreciate you writing this very beautifully written and beautifully designed, I must say, too, book. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
That was my conversation with Mary Jane Rubenstein about her great new book, Worlds Without End, The Many Lives of the Multiverse, published with Columbia University Press in 2014. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion.